What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, this is The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. Today, as the legal back and forth over President Trump's immigration ban continues, a Times investigation goes inside the world of ISIS and finds that terrorists no longer have to cross borders to carry out their attacks. Meantime, the White House has begun to dismantle the rules put in place by President Obama after the financial crisis, rules intended to protect American consumers from Wall Street banks. To understand how upside down that seems, you have to go back to 2008 and remember who won and who lost in the financial crisis, and who, despite that, now regulates the banks that caused the crisis. It's Monday, February 6. Donald Trump is hosting the first season of Celebrity Apprentice.
Welcome to your first boardroom. Mayor Bloomberg had a great time. He liked both Frankfurters, but ultimately, it's how much you sold that counts. Omarosa, how do you think your team did?
I think we did outstanding.
As the year goes on, a cascade of terrible decisions by homeowners craving cheap mortgages, by lenders who lowered their borrowing standards, and by regulators who turned a blind eye to all of it, are conspiring to cripple the United States housing market. But something else is happening, something that turns a bad U.S. housing market into a full-fledged financial meltdown. Wall Street banks are taking those bad mortgages, chopping them up in exotic ways, and selling them to investors over and over for billions of dollars. And in the process,
the stock market is now down 21%.
Because we're now down 43%.
Infecting the entire financial system.
Let's talk about the speed with which we are watching this market deteriorate.
Who knows where this is going to end up? I mean, this is volatility we haven't seen, of course, since way before you and I were born.
From Las Vegas to London, with America's housing crisis.
Two-year note yields went from 190 to 166 in the blink of an eye.
You know what, right now, breaking news here, stocks all around the world are tanking because of the crisis on Wall Street.
One of those banks is Goldman Sachs. And the president of Goldman Sachs back in 2008...
If you would please raise your right hand.
...is a man named Gary Cohn.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm under penalty of perjury...
Remember that name.
Testimony? We'll move to Mr. Cohn.
I would like to begin my testimony with an apology.
Gary Cohn.
It is always useful with hindsight to examine actions taken. Of course, we regret that we didn't do many things better, like having less exposure to leverage loans.
By September, the economy implodes.
We are in the midst of a serious financial crisis, and the federal government is responding with decisive action.
And taxpayers bail out or shore up dozens of major financial institutions that are judged too big and essential to fail.
$700 billion to rescue the country's failing banks.
Including Goldman Sachs, which got $10 billion from the government. There's a massive public outcry and a call for retribution against the banks.
It's wrong that the government's taking our hard-earned money to give to the banks so the banks can lend it back to us with interest.
In 2009, the country's new president, Barack Obama, in office just a few months, has to make a choice.
That's exactly right.
My colleague Charles Duhigg covered the crisis closely for the business section of the Times.
In 2009, the Obama administration is trying to decide, what do we do? Do we try and re-regulate the economic system, the financial system of the United States, or do we punish the people, the wrongdoers, who are clearly making a lot of money off of the backs of normal Americans? And they make this fundamental decision, which is...
There will be... time to punish those who set this fire.
We want to go after improving the system through regulations rather than trying to put the wrongdoers in jail.
Right now we want to put out that fire.
Why can't you do both?
Well, if they had decided to try and put people in jail and re-regulate the financial system at the same time. That's all the Obama administration would have done in their first year. And they have other things they want to get done, like healthcare, for instance. But equally, getting the right regulations through, that's kind of dependent on having the banks go along with what you want to get done. And if you're trying to put the CEOs in prison at the same time that you're trying to convince them to support your regulations, it's going to at least take a much longer than anything else, and it might not get done at all.
So no major Wall Street executives go to jail. Few of them lose their jobs. None are really forced to give back their salaries. That year, Gary Cohn earns $9.6 million at Goldman Sachs. In the end, the only punishment leveled against the Wall Street banks, the only thing demanded of them to prevent this kind of devastation again, is a single piece of legislation.
The Dodd-Frank Law. Right. This is a series of reforms that are put in place that say things like, for instance, banks have to keep more money in their vaults so that they have a bigger capital cushion, a safety cushion if things go wrong. Banks can't use their own money to make speculative bets on the marketplace because that way they're not as exposed to the whims of the market. There's a series of reforms that are put in place to make sure that what just happened in 2008, that never happens again.
If you look at Wall Street right now, what's crazy is that
The same
guys
people
are running the banks as were running them in 2008. This is actually the roots of the Tea Party, right? Is this
absolutely
anger over the elites excluding everyone else, taking advantage of average Americans. And that anger, that frustration, that is the seeds of the Tea Party, which eventually becomes the Trump voter.
The Trump voter, whom Trump promised to be a champion for, and whom he told that his opponent, Hillary Clinton, could not be trusted to take on the banks or hold them accountable, Goldman Sachs in particular.
I would imagine she made very positive statements toward Goldman Sachs and all the people that
she wanted their money.
She wants their money.
On Friday of last week, President Trump signed an executive order that will begin unraveling the Dodd-Frank law.
We're signing core principles for regulating the United States financial system. Doesn't get much bigger than that.
Directly behind Trump when he signed the executive order,
I would like to begin my testimony with an apology,
was Gary Cohn.
It is always useful with hindsight to examine actions taken. Of course, we regret that we didn't do many things better, like having less exposure to leverage.
He left Goldman Sachs in December to chair Donald Trump's National Economic Council. He will now play a key role in figuring out what kind of regulations are needed to prevent Wall Street banks from once again wreaking havoc on the American economy. That whole progression, it feels really outrageous, unless you contemplate the idea that Dodd-Frank was really flawed.
Absolutely. And the reason why is because Dodd-Frank was written for a calamity, right? It was written for
amid a calamity.
It was written amid a calamity. It was written to stop something that happens once every 75 or 100 years. And so it was overbroad. It had some provisions that went too far. I think the fundamental question, though, is who is driving this? Is President Trump driving this to appease voters who are relatively unsophisticated about the details of these regulations and simply sort of want to see the government kind of burn down? Or is it being driven by everyone from Goldman Sachs, who's now working for the Trump administration, who understands very well the sophistication of these regulations and that some of them are absolutely needed and necessary and that other regulations are overly broad? And more importantly, can they reform Dodd-Frank with the precision necessary to make the wise choices, or will the animal spirits of the marketplace or of the electorate or of someone who says, like, I think I can get an extra dollar if they just write something a little bit different and lobbyists? Who's going to win?
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
The Trump White House and federal courts are now locked in a high-stakes legal battle over the president's immigration ban. This weekend, judges in Washington and Minnesota ruled that the ban is unconstitutional and immediately lifted the restrictions on the 7 Muslim-majority countries that it impacts. President Trump is appealing that decision and attacking the Washington state judge who first blocked his order, calling him a so-called judge and tweeting, quote, "If something happens, blame him and court system." Vice President Pence defended Trump's attacks on Meet the Press.
The judge's actions in this case, making decisions about American foreign policy and national security, it's just very frustrating to the president, to our whole administration, right, to millions of Americans who want to see judges that will uphold the law and recognize
all he did was put a pause.
Authority the president of the United States has under the Constitution to manage who comes into this country.
Well, all he did was
that presumes that acts of terrorism depend on crossing into the United States from abroad. What if they don't? Rukmini Kalamaki, actually, describe your beat. Is it the terror beat?
It's become that. I essentially cover the Islamic State.
Rukmini has been reporting for months on a theory she's developed while poring over documents from inside ISIS, documents that challenge our idea of who carries out attacks on Western targets.
What's the generic understanding of what a lone wolf terrorist is?
So a lone wolf, by the definition of the word, is somebody who's acting alone.
Among the fears this holiday, the threat of the lone wolf attack.
Authorities say it looks like a lone wolf attack.
It's usually a he.
This has really become a movement.
In his mother's basement or whatever.
In their mom's basement on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter.
And he's radicalized through the propaganda that the Islamic State or another jihadist group puts out there.
Law enforcement agencies on our shores are warning about the threat of lone wolves.
And decides to take action on his own without any actual connective tissue back to the organization.
A self-starter.
A self-starter, exactly.
Essentially self-radicalizing without any sort of contact with a centralized terrorist organization.
The problem with the term is it's almost never accurate.
Wow.
Let me give you the case of Riad Khan, who's a teenager from Afghanistan living in Germany. And last summer, he boarded a passenger train in the town of Würzburg, Germany, with an axe.
One witness said the scene in the carriage was like a slaughterhouse.
And proceeded to hack people on the train.
This 17-year-old was self-radicalized.
He's described as a deranged young man.
There are no known links to anyone else.
A couple of weeks after that attack, a German newspaper was able to get the chats that were found on his phone. The chat begins with an ISIS handler who says to him, brother, how do you plan to attack? And the young man says, my knife and axe are ready for use.
Wow.
And then the handler replies, brother, would it not be better to do it with a car? And then he explains that the casualties would be much greater. And the young man says that he doesn't have a driving permit. And he says, I can't drive and learning takes time. And he says, I want to enter paradise tonight. So he walks him through recording a video pledge, which gets released basically 14 hours after the attack. And what I want you to notice is how they are in touch up until the minute that the young man boards the train. So he says, I will carry out with an attack with an axe in Germany today. The handler replies, if you're going to commit the attack, Allah willing, the Islamic State will claim responsibility for it. The last message that they exchange begins with the teenager saying, pray that I become a martyr. I'm now waiting for the train. I'm starting now. This young man had never traveled to Syria. As far as we know, he never saw or even heard the voice of the handler who's guiding him. This is all just chats, you know, on a smartphone. And yet they're able, through nothing more than this digital connection, to move this person from intention to violence. And they're able to do it in a very short amount of time. So Let me move from this case to one that takes us back to America. One of the handlers that was most prolific and most successful in taking people to the steppe is a guy called Abu Issa al-Amriki. Al-Amriki usually means the American. To this day, we really don't know who this guy is. What we do know is that he spoke fluent English with American turns of phrases. So in 2015, in around Christmas time, he gets in touch with Emmanuel Lutschman, who's a young man in Rochester, New York. From the 25th to the 31st, so basically 6 days, they chat nonstop. And he manages to take this young man from considering an attack to actually going to Walmart to pick up zip ties, an axe, and masking tape and other things. They were planning to go attack a bar in Rochester and take hostages, kill them on camera, and then use that as a
propaganda tool.
as a propaganda video. Right. So 6 days. 6 days that it took to really completely screw up this young man's life. This is what is now being called the remote-controlled attack.
How detailed and explicit are directions for something like that? Just how much are they dictating the details?
I mean, it was just incredible. You know, like in India. The India case is just stunning because in that case and in several other cases that we found in Europe, etc., ISIS went so far as to essentially arrange weapons drops for them in different places in India. So like one drop was left at the Ajmer train station next to the railroad tracks. Another bag of pistols was left hanging in a plastic bag from a tree at the Nanded airport. And they would just give them the GPS addresses of these locations. You know, like you go to the Nanded airport, look for the railway office. Across from the railway office, you're going to see a tree. Approach the tree. In the tree, you're going to find the bag. It's literally the puppet master.
I want to talk about how this is going to relate to our new president, Donald Trump, and right. his plans to stop terrorism. Ooh. He's built his entire strategy around one form of wall or another,
right.
either a physical one at the Mexico border or an immigration kind of wall stopping people from coming in from Syria or
right.
Iraq. Would that do anything to stop these non-lone wolves that you're describing?
I really don't think so. And the reason that that's not going to do anything is, once again, these people are not traveling to our country. These people are American citizens that are already in Rochester, in Ohio, in Virginia, in Texas, in Phoenix, Arizona, and they are being incited to attack by actors overseas. So the tripwire is not travel. The tripwire is a digital communication with a known terrorist asking them to carry out an attack.
So I've heard you have this theory that I want to end on, that in some ways, though it's not intentional, this ban the Trump administration is pursuing is actually a gift for ISIS.
In a way, you could say that it is. ISIS wants the world to believe that the United States is at war with Islam. It's why the Obama administration and the Bush administration before that made very clear that the war was not with Islam, that the war was with an extremist ideology and with people who are advocating violence. I can read to you a social media post that was put out by a pro-Islamic State channel on the day of Trump's inauguration, which I think makes this clear. The new mule of the Jews, Trump, before assuming power, went to the church to be blessed to continue in the war against Islam and its people of monotheism. Again and again, do not ever forget it's a crusade.
Wow. They took the fact that he went
to church.
The church
yes.
next to the White House.
Yes. Yes. His profession of faith.
They're already like drawing right. on the thinnest possible reeds,
right.
they don't,
right.
then a ban is actually a pretty thick
It's a pretty thick one. It's a pretty thick one. And I mean, let's not make any bones about it. They, of course, would have hated Hillary Clinton as well. And in fact, in some of the channels that I was following, one Al-Qaeda follower put out a long screed where he said there is actually no difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. The only difference is that Donald Trump is making explicit what we know everyone in America already believes, which is that this is a war on Islam. So to them, all of them are the same. But the difference is that Trump is making it transparent. And now they no longer have to go to great lengths to explain to their supporters that this world is not accepting to you, that this is not a home for you.
Thank you, Rukmini.
Thank you.
That's about it for The Daily. Here's what else you need to know. The Patriots, of course, are this year's Super Bowl champions after an incredible come-from-behind victory. And throughout the game, several major American brands, including Airbnb and Budweiser, aired commercials that felt like political statements by touching on immigration and diversity. Coca-Cola actually recycled an ad from 2014, but one that had new resonance in this moment. The show has just started, but we want to know what you like and don't like about it, what you want more or less of, and we want to know who you are. So I'm asking you to fill out a short survey. It's at nytimes.com/thedailysurvey. Fill it out and let us know what you think. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.